This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. Dr. Siti Khairiyya Mohamad Hanafia was recently named the world's best science communicator at the 2018 FameLab International Competition in Cheltenham in the UK. Khai, as she's known by friends, is a lecturer in biological sciences at University Science Malaysia in Penang, and she joins me now to share more about winning that wonderful award. Welcome, Khai. How are you today?
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
And congratulations. You are the world's best science communicator, not just any science communicator, the world's best. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's still very surreal, but very exciting.
Maybe, I mean, for people who don't know what it's all about, what is FameLab? You know, how did you come across it in the first place?
Funny story. My colleague was pestering me to join, actually. I didn't really know much about it at the time, but it's basically a platform to identify the individuals that lie between the science communicators and the scientists.
Okay.
There's this idea that scientists are really bad communicators, and we have to get people who don't know science to really communicate it effectively.
Sure.
But I think this platform was meant to identify, you know, those people who aren't half bad at it, like myself, who also do science.
Sure. So the ones doing the research and also communicating the research, in a
yeah.
sense.
Yeah, and to present science or their scientific research in 3-minute presentations that are clear, have good content, with some charisma, ideally.
Okay. Yes, that was the three C's, right?
The three C's, exactly.
That's right. And your presentation was titled To Find a Hidden Killer. Are you a Harper Lee fan by any chance?
I'm a very big Harper Lee fan. Love To Kill a Mockingbird, but have avoided reading the subsequent novel because of some things I've heard about it. But yeah, actually, To Find a Hidden Killer was my semi-final presentation.
Okay.
Or the tremi-final, because they had three sessions of it.
Okay.
The final one is To Find a Familiar Face.
Okay.
To find something, basically.
Science, isn't that what science is
yeah,
about?
Yeah, exactly.
But maybe you can tell me about what that presentation was based on, the final one.
The final one, right. So I basically wanted to carry from the semifinal, which was talking about some of the general issues with tuberculosis. Mm-hmm. That's one of the main areas of research that I do, specifically in finding new markers to be used for diagnosis.
Sure.
So currently, tuberculosis is diagnosed using, I would say, rather classical methods,
sure.
like using the microscope, growing them on culture. And we only recently had a molecular test, which basically detects the DNA of the bacteria. So that's a faster test, mm-hmm. but it's very expensive.
Okay.
The other two methods are cheaper, but they take a long time because the bacteria grows very slowly. And with the microscope, it really depends on the quality of the sputum that you get, which
sure.
is where you would find the bacteria. And basically, there's a lot of issues in terms of how effectively you can identify people with TB using those methods. And most importantly, those methods are very much lab confined.
Mm-hmm.
So most of the people who do get TB tend to live in areas where it's not as easy for them to get healthcare to begin with.
Right.
So when they show up, you have to take their sample and then you have to send it off to a central lab, and they have to wait weeks sometimes. And what's sad is sometimes they don't even come back because it was so difficult for them to get there in the first place. So this is a real problem in a lot of areas, and people are just basically dying for a very good test that you can use where the patients are at without having them to go to the central facilities and having the samples be sent to the central labs. But for now, that's what's eluding us, and that's one of the main research goals for the field.
Is this in a local context or a global context?
It's a global context. I mean, I think Malaysia, we're quite fortunate that our healthcare network is vast enough.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm thinking sub-Saharan Africa and some parts in India. I mean, India and China are probably the countries with the biggest tuberculosis burden, you would say.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the first talk was just talking about the general problems of that, and also the idea that a lot of people are actually infected,
mm-hmm.
but they are not sick because the bacteria tends to be contained in these structures called granulomas, like these balls, what did I call them? Spherical sleeping bags, that's it. Because, I mean, the bacteria are basically asleep, or so we think, but it can reactivate. So that's where you get new infections later on in the years.
Kind of dormant.
Dormant, yeah. I mean, it's neither here nor there how dormant they are, but that's that's the prevailing idea. And yeah, so the idea is what other signals can we find to tell us who has that latent form of tuberculosis and who will reactivate? So following from that, now I talk about my final talk, which is just the basic idea of using antibodies and antigens as a simple way to detect whether or not somebody has an infection. Okay. So it works for a lot of diseases. HIV is a good example. We've got a lot of rapid tests. So basically simple tests that you can use a finger prick blood or even saliva, I think, for some. And you can just have a good screen whether or not somebody might have the disease. We don't have that for TB, but the approach that I was working on is using that same concept. So the idea that antibodies will recognize specific antigens that they've met before. That means if you get a positive result, that person's seen that bacteria or virus before.
Right.
So that means they're probably infected.
Sounds so simple. Theoretically.
Theoretically, it's the idea itself is simple. But to find that specific match is usually the biggest problem. And then for TB especially, to make sure that it consistently works across different types of people.
Okay.
That's the challenge that we have right now. Like we'll test like 100 people, like, oh, this looks like a really good marker or a really good antigen or antibody, whatever. Then we test it in another group and it's not the same. So there's a lot of human variability with TB.
Okay.
So it's a big challenge for us.
And this is something that you are currently working on. And I mean, how did your interest in this first begin?
Oh, I was hoping you would ask me that. Mainly because one of the reasons I went into tuberculosis research passed away recently.
So he was a
professor that I met when I was doing my master's. His name is Professor Arthur Dannenberg Jr. I met him at a latent tuberculosis seminar. I sat next to him, and I didn't know him. I didn't know anything about TB. I was actually doing public health at the time. But after the presentation, he was just so passionately telling me how everything that presenter said was wrong, because it was against all of his research. And he had a stack of papers, and he had a huge briefcase. He was wearing his lab coat. He was 86, by the way. Retired for a good 20-something years, but he still came to work every day. He still had a lab that nobody really used, but he was just so passionate about it. He literally infected me with the TB. I think after that, I realized, I think I want to work in this. Maybe not exactly the way
he did.
The way he did. He was working more on the pathogenesis, which is basically how the bacteria causes the disease. And he had to work in rabbits to show the mechanism.
Okay.
I'm a bit with animals, so I tried to do something a bit more translational, hence the biomarker research.
Okay. And I mean, you know, in all of this, just going back to, you know, presenting these sorts of topics, what is the most challenging part to explain for you to actually explain your research? I mean, you did it so beautifully here, but, you know, to dumb it down for somebody, you know, like me.
I wouldn't call it dumbing it down at all. I think that's the problem. Like, sometimes it frustrates me when I mean, scientists and non-scientists alike feel like talking about it in simple terms is dumbing it down.
Mm-hmm.
To me, it's like, what are you trying to say, right, to say that? Yeah. I mean, all those facts and details, they're important if you're in a conference when you're talking to people who are pretty much out to get you. But I think when it's with the public and an audience that just wants to know what the idea is, what's the story, just tell them that.
Okay.
So to me, it's identifying what is it that I want to say exactly. And then I guess finding analogies are really helpful, obviously. People need something to link it to.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the rest, I mean, it really depends on the content as well, like how complicated the original content was as well.
And what was sort of like your thought process, you know, because when you were entering this competition, and it's, I think, 3 minutes, isn't
yep.
it? You've got a 3 minute presentation. How did you sort of break it down into, you know, this whole chunk of research and, you know, knowledge, you know, to kind of condense it into those 3 minutes just so people get it straight like
right,
that?
Right, right. Yeah. So obviously I had to choose what I wanted to say and what I didn't want to say.
For sure.
There are a lot of facts and a lot of details, but if it didn't directly impact on where I was heading with the message, then I had to unfortunately take it out. I mean, there are a few things that I could have added a bit more, but it wouldn't give me enough room to drive home some of the key points. So yeah, it was really about editing, I think. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what it's all about. Just editing your thought process, editing the information, just so that everything makes sense and flows well.
And makes good communication,
yeah,
essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm speaking today to Dr. Siti Khairia Muhammad Hanafia. She is a lecturer at USM. She's a biological science lecturer. And she also recently won the world's best science communicator at the 2018 FameLab International Competition in the UK. And after this quick break, we'll find out more about the importance of science communication. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is the very lovely Dr. Siti Khairia Muhammad Hanafia. She is a lecturer at USM. She's a biological sciences lecturer, and she was recently named the world's best science communicator at the 2018 FameLab International Competition over in the UK. And so we were just talking about, you know, your presentation itself. But I mean, science itself, you know, it's such a huge impact on humanity. And I remember reading this article which said that scientists and science communicators are engaged in a constant battle with ignorance. Would you agree?
Yes. Well, I think it's misconceptions sometimes. So we've got scientists who probably think that I'm too serious for this.
Yep.
Or, you know, I have more important things to do. And science communicators are probably quite frustrated that scientists themselves aren't taking it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's their fault. I mean, it is quite frustrating when you think about it. But it's partly the way we've been trained, mm-hmm. I think. We've been trained that we're meant to be impassioned. We're meant to be very objective and, you know, facts and figures. So you can read an abstract and it's so dense.
Yeah.
It's super dense. And at the end of it, unless you really know that topic or you've read similar papers, you'll be lost.
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be the gist of the entire article. So that's the way we were trained.
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading something funny about how you take a good writer and then you train them to write academically and you basically take out all the humor out of that person and then you've got basically a good scientist. And it's interesting because if you read much older papers, they tend to be a bit more flexible with that. There's a bit more storytelling,
okay,
which you can't get away with nowadays. It really is becoming more and more, you know, I'm not sure if the word's economical, but yeah, you're meant to be even more objective nowadays. So I think it's hard for scientists to sort of take off that objective kind of cold hard facts cap
mm-hmm.
of theirs
mm-hmm.
to just tell a story, really. I mean, I think some of my peers might still not see the point of this, but what was nice was when this happened, this FameLab happened, there were quite a few other lecturers and scientists who were quite excited about it. And, you know, I think the desire can be kindled if people see the impact of it. Like when you get to really reach an audience with your work, it's really wonderful.
Yeah.
And scientists are used to the audience really just being other scientists. And I think now we need to think about how we can actually talk to so many more people if we just change our strategy.
And I mean, is that something that as scientists, do you ever, you know, receive any sort of formal training at science communication to the public? Is that, you know,
Well, as a scientist, no, but as part of the competition, so MITE and British Council did a very nice job arranging for a masterclass before we had the Malaysian final. So that was lovely. It was a 2-day thing and basically explaining how to do it, really. And they managed to get some pretty successful science communicators from the UK over the years. In the UK, science communication is a really big thing.
Yeah.
So they've got quite a few people that they can call down. So we had Dallas Campbell, who hosts a few shows in the UK. And yeah, that was probably the only training I've ever gotten on science communication.
Okay. All right. Because it's funny, you know, in the course of this job as well, for me, when I do speak to scientists, and I always feel like, oh, they're not going to talk to me. But they're actually, you know, when they've published research papers, they are glad to be called so that they can actually explain it and actually have people, you know, more people rather than just the science community, for example, to know about it.
Yeah,
I mean, that is
absolutely
something that I imagine you'd want as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's all about that impact, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and in the end, a lot of what the public thinks will feed back into what we do as well. It's going to affect what the policymakers prioritize,
what
the funding bodies prioritize. It is a feedback loop, and it's just nice to feel like, ah, you know, this is why I came here to do this job in the first place. You know, I wanted to do something for the community. We definitely didn't do this job to get rich. it's nice to know that, yeah, we're on the right track, basically.
Okay. But and who do you think? I mean, we know some very mainstream science communicators. The only ones that I can name off the top of my head are like the Neil deGrasse Tysons, the Brian Coxes, the Bill Nyes. But who are some of those that you admire or that you think, you know, is on the right track?
Well, I personally like Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's really funny. Yeah, the other two are all right.
Sorry, I just
wish there were some female names I could
same
choose.
Same here. I realized that.
Out of loyalty, I'll have to say Dallas Campbell's pretty good as well. He's more of a science communicator. Like, so you're talking about scientists who also communicate. Yeah, I'd say out of that list, Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Okay,
yeah, that's
okay.
The one that I like listening to.
I remember speaking to another scientist and he was like, yeah, well, you know, just because they're the best science communicator doesn't make them the best scientist.
For sure. Absolutely. It's not a competition.
You know, some naysayers, shall we call them, they said that more science communication isn't about persuading people, it's actually self-affirmation for those already on the inside.
That's a good viewpoint, I think. One of the things I learned through the experience is that I actually do like what I do. I think as a scientist, you sort of flip-flop depending on how the day goes, how the data turns out. And talking about it to other people, I'm like, hey, yeah, this is actually important. You know, I should stick to this. So it is more of a self-affirmation sort of thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, you've got everything that you know, all the information, but to kind of disseminate that to a broader audience who might not understand all the little nitty-gritty details that you have actually found out.
Right.
I mean, that's another battle, I imagine, that you need to work on when you're working on research papers, for example, or working on communicating that.
Yeah.
Am I right in saying that?
So the nitty-gritty detail, I mean, for starters, I don't know everything. I do know some things. I know some things more than others, but less than others as well. But I think what is the same thing when you're presenting your research to peers, because we have the process of peer review before
for
we
sure.
get published, and it's brutal. But it's feedback.
Sure.
You kind of are working quite closely to something, you know. You develop, unfortunately, biases because you've invested so much. And science is supposed to be somewhat objective. You'll always have a little bit of bias because you want to prove your idea to be right. But it's when you actually share it with other people that you find out, oh, maybe this wasn't the right line of inquiry, or maybe I need to change my methods. And there have been scientists who've changed their complete line of work after getting a few rejections as well, just because they realized that's not going to work out in the long term. And it's the same, I think, if we just take the gist of the research and share it with the public, and the public can tell us, oh, you know, I think that's actually quite interesting and useful for everyone, or they'll be like, why are you doing this? And we're like, why are we doing this? So I think it's a good reality check when you actually try to communicate in whichever way what you're trying to do.
All right. And this is something else that I have some personal interest in, you know, getting more women and girls into STEM. And you know,
science communicators.
Science communicators and also women science communicators, right? Yeah. So, I mean, like I said, we mentioned all the names I mentioned just now, women.
Can't think of any females right now.
Okay.
I'm gonna try to work on this in my brain. Okay. Go on.
well, you are somebody that can be added to that. But from your observations, is there much needed to be done in this area?
You know, that's interesting. For Malaysia, we actually have a lot of women in STEM. You'd be surprised. We're doing a lot better than some countries. And I remember there was a delegate from Australia that came and asked, how is Malaysia doing this? How do you have so many women in STEM? And somebody answered, oh, it's because, you know, girls are more studious, which is somewhat true. I mean, it suits sort of the meticulousness that girls have because that's the way science is taught here. It's more about, you know, how much you know and how much you can regurgitate, for lack of a better word. But that's the women entering science, the women that actually proceed to actually become the lab heads or professors. We're definitely, like everywhere else, that's where we falter. Okay. And one of the key issues that we've identified is the career takes off really parallel to the reproductive years of a woman's life. Okay. So once you have children, it's really a different dynamic. Some types of work really require really long hours in the lab. I've had friends who work in malaria. They'd have to come in at 3 a.m. because that's when the parasites are doing their thing. And it's just difficult to juggle having children with that. So it becomes a real tough choice for a lot of women. Do I stay in science or do I leave and have some children? And that's a horrible decision that a woman has to make. Yeah. I'm very fortunate in that I didn't technically have to make that decision because the decision chose me. I had my first son when I was doing my PhD, but I didn't have as crazy hours as some of my friends did. And I had a very supportive team. So I had my baby and a carrier when we'd had our lab meetings. And I had my wonderful mother actually take about half a year off of her work, unpaid, to look after my son. It takes a village for certain, and especially if you're trying to pursue a career in science especially, it really takes a lot of sacrifice for a lot of people who want to support that effort. And it's that support, I think, that more women need to have so that they don't have to make that choice. Yeah.
And I guess this goes back to the whole, intersectionality of it. You know, there's so many different factors, right? It's not just, oh, men are going not studious enough, so they're not doing it or whatever. Yeah, yeah. It's like there's so many different, you know, there's gender, there's race, there's economic class, there's, you know, family life. Support, life.
Yeah. When life happens.
Well, you were very fortunate then.
I was very fortunate.
And I guess what have you discovered to be effective in helping girls and women, you know, in STEM to continue with their careers?
I think it's such a complicated issue. I think it goes with how we view women in society as well. So I don't have a simple suggestion per se, but I mean, when I had my son, it seemed like the default is, he's going to be with me. I'll have to take care of him. I'm the mom, right?
Yeah.
But I think nowadays people are starting to see, no, you know, men and women are both parents. So there has to be a bit more of not make the default the woman all the time.
For sure.
And that's really going to be a huge perception change,
Mindset change, yeah.
Yeah. But there are things that you can put in place to help support it if the woman does become the default care anyway. Well, like I said, the culture, like having the workspace be conducive enough that if I had to, I can bring my kid. You know, on-site daycare, things like that. I mean, a lot of people have been asking for it for so long. And I think it's about time, we put some real effort in there.
Yeah.
I think it's actually, simple things like that. Understanding that, women tend to have to juggle so many full-time jobs. And we tend to be evaluated as if we had that one job when we're working. And, is that fair or not? I'm not saying we should cut some slack or things like that, but I think this is something that requires some thought about, what is our role in the productivity of a country and what you want to prioritize. So you want both, obviously. You want mothers to look after the kids so they become productive individuals, but you want the mothers to also be a productive part of the workforce. So, yeah, fortunately, I don't have any simple solutions, but daycare would be one of them.
On-site daycare. Daycare. And another simple thing I would think, paternity leave, you know?
Oh, my God.
Eco-paternity
exactly.
leave. Exactly. Right?
I think that's, yep. For sure.
Yeah.
Give the fathers that chance as well. I mean, I think a lot of them do want to be with their children.
Yeah. One would hope, yeah.
Yes, if they had the option to. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess there's a lot that needs to be done. I mean, the gender imbalance question that we're always talking about, you know, it has to come from the government as well, but it has to come from, you know, from people as well,
yeah.
changing perceptions, as you said.
Yeah.
And yeah. But anyway, like you said, you need this. You need the whole camp to kind of help you out. You need the village. So I guess that's something that people need to think about, I suppose, when they're also embarking in research like this.
Yeah. I want to say you can have it all. It's not entirely true, but you should be able to have a good chunk of it, I think. You know, you should be able to have your family, and then you can also have a career.
You shouldn't have to make, like you said, that terrible choice.
That really terrible decision. I mean, I think it's a terrible decision. But
I mean, yeah, for some people,
it's fine.
It's a
but
natural,
I think if you wanted to have both, you shouldn't have to choose.
Yeah. All right, anyway, so just moving on then. So now that you've won this competition, how do you see this moving forward? How are you going to, leverage on that? Or what are your plans moving forward?
I think my immediate plans would be to actually get more people involved in science communication. And what's nice is USM has really embraced it. So now's the time to get more people to think about participating in FameLab next year. Hopefully we can still have it, because I hear funding is a bit of an issue. But but Mike and British Council are on it. But yeah, getting more people to be aware of that platform and to be part of it, maybe training as well. And I'd love to actually work with schools as well, because to me, with adults, you can train them, but it's a bit not too late. But
you want to get them young.
Yeah, you want to get them young. I think one of the problems that we face right now in Malaysia is we've got a real worrying trend of students not taking up sciences. Some of it is probably individual or personal, but some of it is like real systemic barriers. Students don't want to take admats, so because of that, they don't do science. And I think now that I have this opportunity, I would want to convince them it's worth it if they still have to do the admats. And
no one I know likes admats.
I can't remember if I liked it or not. I remember it was very hard.
Yes, very tough.
Yeah. I don't know if it's gotten harder. That's the thing. And it seems like they're also very scared of science because it's gotten harder. Like, science hasn't gotten harder. There must be something the way we've been teaching it, you know?
Yeah, precisely.
So, yeah, I would love to be able to convince more students that science is really a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm. And I think it'd be nice for people to hear, actually, because, I mean, you have a degree in biomedical science from International Islamic University. You've got a master's in global disease epidemiology, which I can't even pronounce, and control from the Bloomberg School of Public Health at Johns Hopkins University. Yeah. And finally, your PhD is in immunology from Monash University.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure this wasn't part of your plan when you were growing up, but how did
definitely,
it...
I planned all of them, for sure.
I'm going to do this here
and
that. Yeah,
exactly. Definitely planned all that. I think when I started, I knew I wanted to do science. I think that's where it all started. Mm-hmm. Exactly what in science, I didn't know. But when I was doing my degree in UIA, I was very fortunate that UIA focuses on a lot of philosophy as well. So a lot of my good friends did English Lit and political science. And so it really shaped some of my worldview, as they like to say.
Yep.
And it actually drove me to, for a little while, become a bit of an anti-vivisectionist. So that's where my animals part. I understand now that's it's a really crucial part of research. But at that point in time, I was like, I don't want to do any lab experience at all. And I fell in love with epidemiology. And because I heard the story about Jon Snow and the Broad Street Pump. So that's how he pretty much the first epidemiologic program, a public health program that worked to prevent cholera in London. And I thought it was amazing. Like, here is scientific research having direct impact. And that's what led me to do a master's in public health. But then, as I said, when I was doing my master's, I met Professor Dannenberg, and I decided, oh, you know what, tuberculosis is so interesting and mysterious, and it kills so many people, it shouldn't, and decided to go back into the lab, but still maintain a bit of that public health impact. And mm-hmm. So that's where I thought diagnostics is where I wanted to go. But ask me again in 5 years what I'll do with that.
Well, I mean, we wish you all the best, and, you know, congratulations
you.
Again. And I mean, I really think that, I mean, you're doing wonderful work, obviously, but, you know, that part of wanting to get the students interested and, you know, telling them is not as bad as it seems, because I remember back in
school. It's worth it. That's what I want to say.
It's worth it. Because, you know, back in school, you know, with our system where if you're clever, you go into the science stream. If you're not so clever, well, then you can do the arts.
Yeah.
You know, and changing that mindset, I think.
Yeah, I think that's one of the problems with the way we teach science, actually. That competitiveness, you know, that filtration of smart versus not smart. I think, obviously, you need to have certain skill sets to be able to do well in science.
For sure.
But it doesn't mean that you should ever hate science. It means science is in your life. It's everywhere. And this is part of the reason why we have this huge divide between scientists and the public. You know, the public remembers science as being this terrible, difficult thing. You know, in time, you begin to sort of fear what you hate.
Yeah.
Or is it the other way around? But yeah, fear and hate, basically. And there's no need for that. I think at the end of learning science, I think a student should have the idea that, okay, I want to pursue this or not, without feeling that I'm too dumb for it, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm.
It should be, in my opinion, the way the science is taught, really. And yeah, I think it's removing that fear of science and getting them to feel that, well, one, if they think it's hard but they want to do it, that it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
And the other, if they don't want to do it, that's fine. And, you know, they can still be interested in it. It's not like an alien thing.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
For joining me today. I've been speaking to Dr. Siti Khairiyya Mohammad Hanafia. She is a lecturer at USM, a biological sciences lecturer, and she was just named the world's best science communicator at the 2018 FameLab International Competition, which was held over in the UK. And if you'd like to watch her presentation, you can actually find that on YouTube, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. And you can find out about her little Brad Pitt joke there. Thank you again. This has been Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.